the government will buy weapons for the army and some of that will disappear. The rebels, we are bringing in arms from Liberia, from diamond dealers. I mean, even in Freetown, you have these militia groups all over the place. All of them were armed. You had the rebels, you had the rogue soldiers, you have vigilante groups.
Lansana Berry says a disarmament process which began in the West African country in 1998, while the country was still at war, was a success for the Sierra Leone government and the United Nations, which provided huge assistance in the years that followed. Hello, I'm Omar Musni, and for this edition of our UN and Africa podcast, we'll be talking to the former UN staffer about what he describes as the miraculous effect that ridding the formerly war-torn nation of battlefield weapons has had on society, the economy, and politics in the country of his birth. We'll hear how the focus on prioritizing the disarmament of rebel forces and various militia, the exchange of weapons for cash, the support of a former colonial power, and general war fatigue contributed to drastically reducing the supply and circulation of small arms in Sierra Leone. Civil war began there in 1991, leading to the arrival of a UN observer mission in mid-1998, and then a mission with 6,000 peacekeepers later the following year. That peacekeeping force was boosted to more than 17,000 in 2001, with an expanded mandate to disarm rebels and child soldiers, together with offering help in organizing the first ever free and fair elections across Sierra Leone. Daniel Dickinson spoke to Lansana Berry, who worked for the UN peacekeeping mission in Liberia and who is now an academic in the country of his birth. He began by asking Mr. Berry to describe Sierra Leone when the disarmament process began in 1998.
Particularly after 1999, when the Revolutionary United Front and the army took over Freetown, almost completely destroyed parts of Freetown. By the time the UN, the United Nations mission began after that really deadly attack on Freetown, over 5,000 people were killed, large parts of the city were almost completely destroyed. There was no way you could actually drive from here to Bo, which is less than 3 hours. There were ambushes along the way in the 90s, so you have to fly. Hundreds of villages were destroyed.
And presumably there were arms everywhere. The country was awash with small arms.
Yes, it was awash with small arms. I mean, arms seems to be everywhere. The government will buy weapons for the army and some of that will disappear. The rebels, we are bringing in arms from Liberia, from other sources, from diamond dealers. I mean, it was awash in arms. I mean, even in Freetown, you have these militia groups all over the place. All of them were armed. You had the rebels, you had the rogue soldiers, you have vigilante groups. Every one of these people were armed, with small arms, AK-47 rifles. And sometimes, if they are really in the interior, some of these small vigilante groups had artisanal weapons, which the local blacksmiths made, but they could kill people. Yes, it was really a wash in arms at that time.
And presumably it was very easy to get hold of arms.
Oh, yes. I mean, at one point, I mean, when I was researching my book on Sierra Leone, I know you could buy a fairly brand new AK-47 rifle for less than $50 if you want to, if you actually ask for it. As long as you know the right network, you can buy weapons fairly easily without any restrictions, because there was hardly any real control anywhere in the country except in parts of maybe the big cities, Freetown and other major ones.
And of course the effects were devastating, so many people killed and maimed. Can you draw a picture of what that looked like at the time?
One of the first things that would strike a visitor after, say, 1999, we had many people whose arms had been cut off, amputated, cruelly amputated by rebels. I mean, you could see them almost everywhere. In the Freetown area alone, I think the Medicine Sans Frontières people estimated that there were several thousand people who had been cruelly amputated. I mean, there were people who have been shot, who we have been taken care of by the aid agencies. The health system had almost completely collapsed. It had been taken over by international aid agencies, particularly MSF, Medicines Sans Frontières. It was almost a really hellish place. I remember one journalist came from the U.S. and said, and wrote an article, I think, in the New York Review, saying this is the worst place on earth. That was when the Revolutionary United Front abducted UN peacekeepers, about 300 or 500 of them. This is in 2000, even when we had all thought that the war was winding down.
The war actually finished in 2002, but presumably there were still very many weapons on the streets. It was still a militarized country.
It wasn't militarized after 2002. I mean, here is what they did, and they did extremely well. The government and the UN, they were able to collect weapons from everywhere, and they made it clear that no civilian, nobody should keep any weapons. So the agencies, the police and other EMP, they were actually going entering people's houses to recover arms, and some of them were selling them back to these agencies. So no, it wasn't a washing arms anymore. Which I think it was really miraculous that you'll hardly find even these locally made shotguns after 2002. Most of the hunters, farmers were complaining that wild animals were destroying their crops because they don't have guns to shoot them.
You describe government people going from house to house to pick up weapons. That sounds a pretty dangerous and difficult task, but perhaps it's not as dangerous as one might think.
No, it wasn't. Now, here's what happened. The official disarmament process was very much targeted to the fighting forces, to the Revolutionary United Front, the civil defense, and parts of the army that had gone rogue. And that one was done with the huge assistance of the UN, and they were able to collect these weapons from them in exchange sometimes for money, I think, in many cases for money. And here's what happened that was very striking. Some of these, especially the civil defense people, new people who had weapons. So they will go to those houses, to those people, and take those weapons away from them. Sometimes they buy them for small amounts, and then they come back to sell those weapons to the agencies collecting those, doing the DDR agencies.
The Disarmament, Demobilization and Reintegration Agencies.
Exactly.
Yeah,
yes,
DDR,
yes,
yeah.
I met one young fellow who had served with the civil defense forces, who actually was able to surrender 12 weapons.
And make a bit of money on the side, it sounds like.
He made quite a bit of money on the side, yes. So once he had collected those weapons from the fighting forces, it was fairly easy. And, you know, what happened in Sierra Leone, like Liberia, was that the police force was terribly corrupt, had been degraded, but it still existed. And there was still part of the army that had not gone completely rogue. The government was able to use those ones effectively to collect weapons. I mean, they went from village to village, and I think it was comprehensive. The initial stages of the disarmament process, weapons were not commensurate with the number of people who were being disarmed. For example, at one point, 35,000 or 40,000 were said to have gone through the process, but they had only surrendered about over 20,000 guns or so. But later on, I think more weapons were surrendered.
Do you know how many weapons in total were surrendered?
Maybe about 30,000-something. I mean, the real fighting weapons, the real, not the shotguns, not the hunting rifles, but the ones that, like the automatic rifle guns and that, around 30,000-35,000 or so, and heavy guns and RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades. Those were the ones that were particularly targeted at the initial stages, but then later on, they targeted even local hunting rifles.
And what about the people who didn't want to give up their weapons? Were there many of those people?
Not at all. Not after they had disarmed the main fighting forces. There was, in a sense, exhaustion has set in. Many people, especially after the defeat of the RAF, and then with the UN troops on the ground, everyone realized that it was a suicide to start any armed campaign.
So it sounds as though it was a pretty successful process. What made it so successful?
I think it was extraordinarily successful, the disarmament process was. Part of it, I think, was because of the utter defeat of the Revolutionary United Front. And, of course, by that time, the UN forces had grown to, I think, around 16 or 19,000 or so. And you can see them almost everywhere, and that really helps.
There is still plenty of conflict across the world, in Africa and further afield. What can other countries learn from the experience of Sierra Leone?
I think one lesson to, because I'm just thinking of Sierra Leone and then comparing to, say, Liberia, which had a similar process. Sierra Leone process was more dramatically successful than the Liberian one, in part because there was a major power supporting the government, which was the UK. That backup of the UN forces sent a strong message. And whoever you are, the Sierra Leonean, the sense that you are having the British, who were our former colonial masters, out there to settle that problem, I think what psychologically was very powerful, because it really did have the support of ordinary people. But also, the government of Sierra Leone, the fact that the government never imploded completely, there had been an election in 1996, and that government was really supported across the board in Sierra Leone by many people, that succeeded in delegitimizing the rebel forces, that played a key role in convincing them that because that government had international support, UN and other regional support, that it was impossible for them to overthrow that government successfully. So in a sense, elections are overrated, but elections can have, I think, a legitimizing effect on governments, and that can go a long way in conflict resolution.
And of course, disarmament is only one part of the complicated jigsaw puzzle which follows a war, and has to be seen in the light of the longer process, which includes demobilization and the reintegration of fighting forces into society, the DDR that you mentioned earlier.
Yes.
On. How important is it to think in terms of disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration?
When the process is really underway, the emphasis is normally on disarmament. The mobilization part of it is closely linked to the disarmament part of it. The real problem then begins when it comes to reintegration, because you have so many thousands of these former fighters who will be without jobs, some of them undergo training to do all kinds of things. I remember in Sierra Leone, you had quite a number of them wanting to be drivers, who were trained to be drivers. And at one point, I spoke to some of them, and these are people who, during the war, I mean, when they loot cars, they couldn't actually drive them. And so they were disadvantaged. So they thought driving was something glamorous. Some wanted to be tailors. So you had hundreds of them taking to professions that we cannot simply be sustained by the economy. So that became a problem. But if there is a general improvement in the economic situation, then you'll see them gradually going back home and engaging in other activities.
And presumably many of these returning men were fighters who had carried out terrible atrocities.
Yes, many of them, almost all of them, were fighters who had killed people, including their own relatives. But again, I mean, there was that truth and reconciliation process, which I think one of its success was actually to have meetings all across Sierra Leone to tell people, accept them. There was some evil that happened here. But that evil, thank God, is now gone. So accept them back. There's this Creole saying, you cannot disown a family member. That saying went around, and you had religious ceremonies and traditional leaders all performing ceremonies of acceptance, of forgiveness. One of the things that struck me when I started going to some of those communities a few years after the war ended, you didn't find reprisal attacks.
How is Sierra Leone looking 20 years after these disarmament programs began? Is there a sense of optimism and a feeling that Sierra Leone is moving in the right direction?
Compared to what it was before, of course, yes. I mean, the change is dramatic. Sierra Leone just recently conducted elections, and that went on successfully. So we've now had changes of government several times over without any actual violence. There are real problems still, high levels of poverty, food problems and inflation, people not be able to afford things that they should afford in a more vibrant society. But the problems, people are tackling them in the ways that you've always tackled them. I think there is a sense of real optimism talking to ordinary people that Sierra Leone has turned a corner.
That was former UN peacekeeping staffer Lansana Barry from Sierra Leone talking about how disarmament helped turn his failed state around. He was talking to Daniel Dickinson of our UN news team. I'm Omar Musni. You've been listening to UN and Africa, our bi-monthly podcast. Please join us again soon.